Right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to begin by welcoming you. Thank you very much for coming to our panel this evening. We do know that there are more people on their way, but it's a slightly earlier start than usual for our seminars, so people are making their way from class and work over the place. So today, this is part of the LSE Festival, and you can tweet about it. There is a hashtag New World Disorders or hashtag LSE Festival if you want to talk about any of the issues raised in today's talk. My name is Dr. Shakuntala Banerjee. I'm in the Department of Media and Communications, and I'll be chairing the panel today. It is my great pleasure to welcome Professor Meena Danda, who's Professor of Social Philosophy and Policy at the University of Wolverhampton, and Sarah Benet-Weiser, who's Professor of Media and Communications in the Department of Media and Communications, and Dr. Bermal Aydin, who is our Scholar at Risk in the Department of Media and Communications. The kinds of subjects I'm going to be talking to them about today have arisen in the course of their research, and when we put the panel together, we were all very aware that the types of trolling and doxing and online abuse that academics are facing around the world are going up and up, and there doesn't seem to be very much will or perhaps even way in the management of this kind of online social disorder which people are facing. So you might do a piece of research and you might find yourself unexpectedly part of a Twitter storm or facing something like the academics who wrote about women and gaming did in the Gamergate event. You might have your documents released online to the public, your private and personal documents released online to the public, or you might find, like some of our speakers today, that your entire life is turned upside down, your passport is cancelled, and you find yourself having to flee from your home. So there's a whole range of things that could happen to you based on the work you do. And in exploring these issues, of course, you realize that this is quite a personal and troubling topic. So we are very aware that it might also be so for you, some of you in the audience. I'll invite each speaker to answer a question. They'll speak for about 5 minutes. There are a couple of them have slides. And then I'll do a follow-up question. So we hope to go for about 20 to 25 minutes in that format. And then for the last 25 minutes, I will open it to the audience for question and answers. And when you are invited to speak, please say who you are and then speak directly to the speaker you wish to answer your question. Thank you. Okay, so to begin, Sarah, you're going to tell us something about your new book, which is going to be available to buy outside and which you will be signing after the talk.
Okay, that wasn't exactly how I was going to begin with my own book and signing it. But yes, it's available outside, and I will sign it.
I can reframe that as a question. tell us about why you want to speak about this topic.
I'm happy that you brought it up. I have a book came out a couple months ago called Empowered: Popular Feminism and Popular Misogyny, which I've been working on for the past 5 or 6 years, and so have feel like I kind of have really taken a deep dive into many of the issues that Shaku just mentioned in terms of what dangerous scholarship might look like. And actually, when you approached me with this idea about this panel and we talked about it as being dangerous scholarship, I've been kind of reflecting on that ever since, what it means to conduct and produce dangerous scholarship. What is the danger in dangerous scholarship? How do we approach it? How do we react to it? And so on. So for the brief 5 minutes that I have, I want to talk about two different dangers that I see in my own, that kind of have come up in my own work on misogyny and feminism. One is that I started to write a book on feminism. I started to write a book on what I called popular feminism, which was the emergence and heightened visibility of feminism across all media platforms. Things like anything from t-shirts that said this is what a feminist looks like, to Beyonce, to pins that you wear on a lapel at an awards ceremony to signal Time's Up or Me Too, to women's marches, and all these different kinds of iterations and performances of feminism that I was noticing. Mainly in the context I was looking at, which was North America and Europe. Every single time that I looked, that I took a deeper dive into one of these feminist performances or expressions, without exception, there was a hostile rejoinder to that, whether or not that was online comments about body shaming and slut shaming on things like Tumblr pages or Instagram accounts or Twitter. As Shaku said, Twitter storms that followed simply something like Me Too becoming a hashtag and then a movement. Every message about female confidence and body positivity, there was something that challenged it. There was Gamergate, so when women dared to enter into the field of game development and create different kinds of games or even the same kinds of games, they were threatened with rape and had death threats. They were forced from their homes and so on. So when feminism is sort of in the water in the way that I think it is in the current moment, it's not surprising that we witness a backlash from patriarchal culture, because backlash and opposition to feminism is not new. What is surprising, or what I see as slightly different, is the way in which this backlash is networked across different media platforms, where it doesn't just lash back, but it lashes out in all directions. And so this is something that I started, I started this book to be about feminism, and it soon became a book about the relationship between feminism and misogyny. And so what I argue in the book is that you have to actually understand it as a relationship rather than as two discrete kinds of phenomena, but it's something that, two sorts of ideologies and sets of practices that are deeply entwined and constantly warring it out on this battlefield of culture. So for me, just to kind of define what I mean by misogyny, I think that it has become popular for some of the same reasons that feminism has become popular. Misogyny is expressed and practiced on multiple media platforms. You can find the vast majority, and there's plenty of studies about this, or vast majority of online abuse and harassment is misogyny directed at women. Misogyny also attracts like-minded groups and individuals. It's about a certain kind of popularity of misogyny, as well as it being kind of exercised and struggled over on the terrain of the popular, and the terrain of popular culture. So, in this sense, popular misogyny follows a pretty conventional definition of it, which is a basic hatred of women. But I also think that we need to pay attention in this particular moment to a more nuanced understanding of what popular and online or networked misogyny is. It's the instrumentalization of women as objects, where women are a means to an end, a systematic devaluing and dehumanizing of women.
That's not a comment. I've gone to the wrong room.
I could just tell.
Your topic is fascinating. I'm supposed to meet somebody next door. Sorry.
It's totally fine. I didn't mean to call him out. I just couldn't help it. So again, popular misogyny is like feminism, is networked, and it's an interconnection of nodes in all forms of media and practice. Of course, misogyny is not only expressed and practiced by men. That should be self-evident and a given. Women are also part of its formation. We see this happening in the United States time and time again, where women hold up misogynistic principles and policies in the government. It's also critiqued and challenged by many, and that is something that I want to end in the second question with really asking us to pay attention to. It is something that is critiqued and challenged, even if it's beginning to be expressed as sort of this norm. So it also has different iterations. Misogyny doesn't land on bodies in the same way in all situations, which is why, we have to think about things that how misogyny has a different valence depending on things like race and caste and class. As the black feminist Moya Bailey has coined it, misogynoir, which is also something that is about how misogyny works across different intersections.
That's great, Sarah. Thank you very much. I'm going to invite Mina now to try and answer that question.
Oh, wait, I had a whole other part.
That
was 7 minutes? Okay.
There's a book out there waiting for you.
Thank you, Shaku, for inviting me. And I am acutely aware of perhaps the insignificance of me talking about a little bit about myself today, but that's what I'm prepared to do. So we know that threats to scholars and activists have intensified globally. Chaku just mentioned, and the severity of the threat is actually horrifying. I'm very concerned about the safety of several academic activists who are incarcerated, some of them my friends, and facing likely arrest, and I'm talking about India, okay, the big democracy. So the latest attack on voices of dissent in India, of students, of teachers, of human rights activists are actually frightening. So you have here, to begin with, just yesterday, this news from yesterday of a young assistant professor, assistant lecturer who lost her job because in a TV discussion with an ex-army officer, she said that India should not go to war with Pakistan. And it's amazing that the very next day this happened after the Pulwama attack of a suicide bombing which killed 40 men from the Central Reserve Police Force in Kashmir. And in many other places at this point in India, students and teachers are being suspended for simply expressing sympathy with Kashmiris in their FB posts. I mean, that's enough to make some student lose their position, or for a lecturer to lose their job. And there is, of course, the whole other use of the state in fabricating charges against academics. And there are several academics already incarcerated. And a good friend of mine, someone who we are hoping will not be, Professor Anand Theltumde, is a case I do know of, who is also facing this imminent arrest. So in comparison with these threats, my own experience of coming under attack for my work on caste in Britain is absolutely minuscule, but that's what I'm going to talk about very briefly today. And I will share it for two reasons. That I think, one, that the beginnings of intolerance of dissent are usually personalized. A person saying something to B person, and you know, we can ignore it or we can do something about it. That's how it begins. And two, the institutional means of controlling challenging ideas can be very, very subtle before they become full-blown clampdown on critical thought. And so I faced this kind of very mild, though disturbing, attack in the UK in the context of my published work on caste discrimination in the UK. So on the one hand is a personal and direct attack. I'll give you an example of that. And the institutional and very subtle diplomatic response, which actually is from LSE. Okay, so maybe I offered a provocation. I won't deny that. So I once described Dr. Prakash Shah, who I have differed with over a number of years, as a denier of caste. So in response to my article in Radical Philosophy, Dr. Prakash Shah wrote a joinder, which Radical Philosophy refused to publish because it consisted of, you know, several very personal and several ad hominem arguments. So you see, he says that what you do in effect is to reveal how moronically radical philosophers think and talk about India. So I think some people here will identify with, you know, being in that club with me. Okay. So further, he accused me, of course, of colonial consciousness. This is what he says, moronically radical philosophers. And he says, he accused me of colonial consciousness. He says, you go on being an inauthentic imitator divorced from your own experience. And I think this really takes mansplaining to another level. Okay. So his views are actually sadly echoed in some stakeholder responses to the research on caste in Britain, which pains me, you know, that this is not just a lone academic. What he's saying is picked up by other stakeholders they will just repeat what he has said. And my project colleagues and I aim to articulate what I thought was the best means of protection for victims of caste discrimination in the UK. And we were chided for simply raising the issue. My second example, which is here, is of institutional interference, where talk of caste-based oppression was not allowed. So I was invited to deliver a lecture commemorating the 350th anniversary of Guru Gobind Singh Ji, and it was due to take place on the 24th of November 2017. You can see the notice, which I had retrieved. I just saved it once. It was almost unbelievable that I had been asked in the first place. And to be absolutely certain, I actually asked again, check my suitability. Are you sure you want me to come and speak? And, you know, I was assured, no, it was the best choice and the committee has decided to do it. And they also published my abstract. So what was I going to do in the abstract here? Well, I was going to say that, to praise Sikh teachings. I was going to praise Sikh teaching. I was going to say that Sikhi has taught us not to ignore or to tolerate or to condone oppression. I was going to focus on caste-based oppression and say that actually we should not be afraid of the visibility of conflict, because when you see conflict, when oppression becomes conflict, it's actually a sign of vitality. It means that we are able to raise these issues. It's not hidden. And I also sort of very kind of wonderfully said, wherever challenges to casteism occur, their truthfulness and courage live on. So I was going to do what radical philosophers do best, uphold the critical perspective. I wanted to discuss casteism precisely in order to celebrate the life of a guru who formed the Khalsa on anti-caste lines. I wasn't allowed to. Okay, so the High Commission, who were joint sponsors, subtly and diplomatically tried to persuade me to remove mention of cases of caste discrimination. So they used the plea of being mindful of the feelings of the Sikh community. And we had long telephone conversations. I thought this was unnecessarily limiting. I have a more charitable view of the Sikh community. I think they are able to and they can listen to criticism. But there is one view which is projected on from a very narrow perspective of what people are willing to listen to. And that's what happened in that case. So the LSE decided to cancel my lecture. Here's the notice. And note that in the process, they also removed the abstract from the website. So now there is no remnant of it. What I showed you is actually something that was covered, but not my favorite paper, but in the Daily Mail, Daily Mail Online. Daily Mail Online had a huge article written by David Dawkins, which captured the tensions around the legislation on caste at that point. And that's what we got, which is the only evidence which remains of my now missing abstract. I think that this actually raises the questions that we face. This is my last slide. We are in this position where research, in the research environment, we are supposed to link research with activism, that is public engagement, and impact of research. And the university, of course, seeks connections with the organization, and the High Commission is a venerable organization. And in this environment, if we see for my example, I'm worried that critical perspectives are in danger of being filtered out. So can we expect to retain our freedom and try to do what we can for public understanding of social problems in our own way? And connected to that, maybe we'll come to in the next round, is the issue of how do we define impact. If we are only challenging rigid public opinion and we are unsettling these rigid public opinions, are we actually having impact? Or because we haven't changed policy, are we having impact? That's the question that worries me. So whilst we do not face the horrendous prospect of incarceration for pursuing our ideas or standing up for our values, we do face the threat of containment of research in narrowly defined impact, encroachment on intellectual freedom, and both lead to simmering insecurities due to pursuing unpopular research agendas. So I'll stop here now.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Meena. Tamal.
Go there. Meena, could you allow me? Hello again, and thank you. And thanks for having me, and thanks for coming. Today I would like to talk about the current crackdown on academics in Turkey, especially Academics for Peace, along with my personal story as one of the signatories of the peace petition. And I used to be a lecturer at Mersin University, and my life has fundamentally changed after signing the petition. As you can see, the petition was simply calling on the Justice and Development Party government to stop ongoing violence directed to Kurdish civilians in predominantly Kurdish cities and towns, especially after the three-year ceasefire ended in 2015. But in Turkey, freedom of expression is broadly oppressed, and since anything not deemed pro-government is regarded as terrorist propaganda or treason, especially when it comes to some politically dangerous subjects such as the Kurdish issue, the Armenian issue, and so on. And the aforementioned subjects are also dangerous to study, to teach, and to research on at Turkish universities. And in the aftermath of the peace petition, and which was clearly related to the Kurdish issue, there was a kind of severe crackdown on the signatories of the petition. And in this sense, Turkey's President Erdogan publicly accused the signatories of being traitors, immorals, so-called intellectuals, and finally terrorists. And you can see some of his statements. And he also publicly urged prosecutors and rectors to punish the peace academics. As a result of that, hundreds of signatories of the petition lost their jobs with no prospect of working again, and some of us being put under judicial and administrative investigations, some having facing imprisonment, and some having been subject to travel bans due to passport cancellations. And in so doing, the current regime in Turkey has sentenced the peace academics to living a civil death through taking away their basic rights from their hands. And that is what precisely happened to me after signing this petition. I was dismissed from my job at Mersin University. I received some threats and even some life threats via social media on Twitter. And this is, of course, in Turkish, and you can see that that's the predominant, actually, outstanding threats that I received. And there are just translations of them, like, everybody wants something, and I want those who betrayed my beautiful country to die disgracefully. The traitors will go away. I think throwing Molotov and digging ditch and pretending to be democratized became the character of traitors. That's just some threats that I received via social media. And after that, I realized there was no way to continue my scholarly activities or even any guarantee to retain my freedom or to survive. And after that, I got in touch with the Council for At-Risk Academics, or shortly CARA. And afterwards, I came to the UK with a scholarship opportunity provided by CARA and LSE. And 10 days after I arrived in the UK, my passport was cancelled by an emergency decree. And I was banned from any civic duties by the same decree in Turkey. And in this regard, I can say that the coup attempt of 2016 gave the AKP government a great opportunity to silence all critical voices through accusations of terrorist propaganda and treason. And according to Scholars at Risk report, almost 7,000 higher education personnel and predominantly academics have been dismissed from their jobs and banned from civic duties, along with passport cancellations. Unfortunately, as a result of these injustices, a young colleague of us, Mehmet Fatih Tıraş, who was one of the signatories of the petition, committed suicide. Mehmet ended his life because he lost all his hopes about his future. And he had dismissed from his job at Çukurova University in Turkey, and he wasn't accepted by any other university to work as an academic due to his signature on the peace petition. And what should we do against this organized evil that cost Mehmet's life then? And yeah, he is Mehmet Fatih Tıraş. As subjects at the receiving side of authoritarianism, persecution, and fascism, We have to act for the great trinity again: liberty, fraternity, and equality. Considering we are presently seeing an authoritarian turn across the world, we have to fight against this within transnational solidarity networks. And we must create alternative ways of intellectual production beyond the neoliberal academia. But we must also challenge the established norms of the university itself. And finally, we must remember that progressive social change only occurs if enough people come together and demand it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bemal. Thank you to all my speakers. Since Bemal has already started us off by suggesting ways forward, I'm going to ask you, Sarah, and then Mina, to respond to the question of how do we move away from this terrible situation or try and make things better in some way. It looks like quite a bleak picture out there.
Sure. First of all, I thank you for sharing your stories here with me, with everybody here. I think that one of the things that is so clear about this is that there is a general move to silence, and that silencing can take different forms. It can be about incarceration. It can be about the disappearance of someone online and someone's abstract online. It can be about a suicide. It can be about taking a passport away. And so I think that one of the things, just to echo what you were saying, Bemal, one of the things that we need to do is challenge this kind of move and these efforts to silence. The other dangerous part of scholarship that I was going to mention, and I'll just do it really quickly, my students are here and they've heard this before, is that in the last month or last several months, there's been three instances that I've been personally involved with that have been about silencing women and silencing feminists in particular. One was someone who came to a talk that I gave, who, and then in the Q&A, shouted me down. Didn't interrupt the actual talk, but waited till the Q&A. Another was at the LSE, where the centennial professor Kimberly Crenshaw was here giving a workshop for students on intersectionality and justice, and along with the head of Department of Gender Studies, Claire Hemmings, and a man came and interrupted this talk aggressively and in a hostile way and had to be removed by security. You can read Claire's statement on the Gender Studies website. The other one is that just happened 2 weeks ago was at my former institution, USC, where the feminist Roxane Gay and a sexual assault survivor activist Amanda Nguyen were giving a talk, a presentation to hundreds of people about sexual assault survivors. And during the Q&A, again, a man came up and accused them of being basically agents of the state. And also this person was from the left, right, from the Communist Party in the United States. So took over the stage, silenced women who were there about sexual assault. So what do we do about to challenge this silencing? And there's so much advice, and so much of it is contradictory. Don't respond. Haters gonna hate. Don't read the comments. I mean, I think there's Taylor Swift wears a bracelet that says "Don't read the comments." And we should all follow Taylor Swift's advice on feminism, by the way. Don't engage. I would like to just end with some different kind of advice. Rather than see these relationships between silencing of critical thought or exile from an entire nation because you signed a peace treaty, or being a victim of misogyny, rather than see these as discrete events or discrete things that happened to us, I'd like to just again echo what you said and talk about how we can leverage these kinds of events to form new solidarities and new coalitions, rather than be always in the defensive mode. In other words, we should be ready for it. We should, as Sarah Ahmed has said, we should occupy ourselves with what she calls the snap, the feminist snap. And the snap for her is to imbue all of these moments with a history, that the snap has a history. It's not something that just happens in the moment. It's something that has a past that comes before it. And as she says, a snap might seem sudden, but the suddenness is only apparent. A snap is one moment of a longer history of being affected by what you come up against. When this guy yelled at me and yelled me down during the Q&A at my talk. A room full of people shouted him down. When this person was accosted, Kimberly Crenshaw and Claire Hemmings on this campus, security came, a room full of students also stood behind them, and he was taken away. When you know, Roxane Gay and Amanda Nguyen were on the stage, the whole place erupted. It's a scary moment. And it's very hard to sometimes not just give in and just let it happen and not respond. But I do think that these moments are the moments where we can form solidarities and form coalition so that we continue to speak the truth to power and not allow this to kind of take over in the way that you suggested.
Thank you, Sarah. Mina, you get the last word on this.
Okay, hi. I will just focus on two things in line with the overall approach I have to these issues. One is that I think we have to stop being always only reactive. I think that if we are responding to horrible situations when a lot has already happened, we are fighting a losing battle. And although I'm very sympathetic about, to this demand we've always had about building solidarity, but I think that the small changes that begin to happen should be plugged right from the beginning. And institutional structures are hugely important in my view. If right in front of our eyes things change, the way things are organized, departments, heads, this, that, and the other, who gets to speak what and who gets to decide what, all of these very, very tiny things that happen right in front of us, but we don't either take them seriously or don't think that they are in the long run that important, but they are important. I certainly know in the Indian case that big changes have happened because over the years, heads of different research organizations have been changed. And so people are in a position to change the lives of other people because they have accumulated power over a period of time. And this has happened bit by bit by bit by bit. And I think when we look always from the human personalized perspective, which is what we are, as radical people, I would say we tend to do a lot. We are failing to engage with institutions as much as we really ought to. So we are a part of the power of the system. I think we can't forget the fact that as university professors, readers, whatever little decision making we have, or as student leaders, whichever position we have, we are a part of this system. And we've got to keep our eyes open when it is changing in front of us. So that's, therefore, I made this comment. It looks a bit way out and not connected. I made this comment about how research and impact and engagement and all those demands are connected, because that is changing the way we do social science and humanities radically. Mm-hmm. And although on the surface it looks like, for those of us who are interested in making a difference, that now the ball is in our court and we are doing good. No, I think the whole idea of impact is being defined in a particular way, which is not giving us that space of critical thinking that we want. So I think we have to dig our feet here and do what we can through REF or whatever exercise and demand what exactly is the, what does impact mean? What do you want us, where do you want us to have impact? And is it not impact if I manage to create a lot of disturbance amongst a lot of people? Is that not impact? Why is it not impact? So I think we need to do that. So in our context, that is my suggestion. But there are so many difficult and serious matters about when we are at that end, as I mentioned, Anil Tenthumbre, who's facing arrest, and other people who have already been arrested, and in your own case, I think that's a different kind of different kind of support structure we need to think of. And there, I think actually courage is hugely important. I know many people who are afraid of speaking these names. They are afraid of putting their name on a signature. Nobody is ever going to come to them, but they are afraid. And I think that is a shame. You know, we have become very weak in not doing something which should come naturally. It should be our duty as educators to put our name to something which is going wrong, and we aren't doing that. And second, I think the monetary aspect is also really important, because in many places, a lot of people who are fighting these struggles are doing with virtually no support. They don't have very little support, you know, for legal battles or for everything else. And there, if someone can think of some solidarity building way where we can help, those of us who are in the wealthier parts of the world, to provide some kind of
a fallback for those who need it, then I think that would be wonderful too.
Thank you so much. Thank you to all my speakers. Please, thank you. I would now like to open the floor to questions. When you get the mic, which is going round, please say who you are and then try to keep your question as a question rather than as a longish statement. So, anybody, please, to any of the speakers.
Hi, my name is Ram, and I'm a PhD student from the media department at LSE. I'm just concerned about how, you know, the way of thinking about dangerous scholarship is rooted in the idea of having been attacked. Mm-hmm. And that precise kind of category of victimhood is now being used on the right.
Oh, yes.
You know, there's this chap in Cambridge who's working on colonialism, and he talks all the time about being attacked or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do we think through dangerous scholarship in a way that can be distinguished, you know, and not fall into this trap? So,
Great question to all of you. I should just premise that by saying we were thinking of inviting him to this panel, so we ended up not doing so.
I think that's a great question, and I actually think that this is something that is happening more and more frequently. You can see it in this, especially a kind of white male victimhood that is being claimed. I think part of the, from my position, part of the problem is exactly what you had kind of said about it being being kind of a personal or individual thing. When victimhood is expressed as something that where you as an individual are attacked, it becomes a kind of malleable category. It becomes something that can flip and be appropriated by other people. My colleague Lily Huliarki has also written brilliantly about this, about how it is that victimhood is sort of disarticulated from those who have historically suffered and reallocated to people who are in positions of power, a reallocation that ends up being about, you know, kind of strengthening those positions of power. So I think also our colleague from the gender department, Leticia Sabse, has written on this with Judith Butler and Zeynep Gambetti about the kind of, I think we should be thinking about vulnerability rather than victimhood. That vulnerability for us can be mobilized in a particular kind of way that is not as in opposition to resistance or not as a response to being attacked, but actually as something that can be resistance itself. So.
I would just slightly not disagree, put it in a different way. In fact, a few months ago, I spoke at Nottingham under the title "Emergent Vulnerabilities and Feigned Hurt." So there is as much on which is happening on the question of caste with right-wing Hindus saying that it is Hinduism which is under attack when you raise the question of caste. That's what I'm being told. So that's exactly an example of what you just asked. And I wonder, therefore, that vulnerability in itself may not necessarily stem this appropriation, because this is a new emergent vulnerability, you know. But there is, I suppose, there is room for academic work to be done on that score. But I think there must be something about the way we make slogans out of our histories, right? So there's a history of oppression, and there's a story to be told, and then at the end comes the slogan which we use. And I think it is that aspect of trading slogans which makes it easily as a cash. You know, you can move from one thing to one group can use it, and another group can use it, and a third group can use it. So I suppose the antidote to that is to really always carry on the struggle on history in the forefront, bring it back to history. So again, it's about making our cultural stories or what our engagement with cultural politics more substantial. Okay, it sounds hopelessly abstract, but I don't know if I got across what I want to
Thank
say.
Thank you, Emma.
Well, yeah. According to me, dangerous scholarship is being subject to severe pressures because you are announcing your thoughts, your ideas, or it may be
teaching on, studying on, or researching on dangerous subjects in anywhere of the world. And in this case, I think supporting academics at risk is quite important. But also when we do that, we should avoid a problematic and institutionalized Western gaze that sees exiled or at-risk academics as humanitarian projects who needs to be protected temporarily. And I think we should just save ourselves from this kind of mindset. And we should start to see exiled or at-risk academics as peer fellows and well-qualified fellows
who have fought a battle on behalf of everyone and maybe paid the price. So I have three different questions, one here, lady in the green, and then over there, and at the back.
Thank you very much, all of you. I'm Dawn. I'm a PhD student here at the LSE in Sociology. And my question is, the point about history, I think, is really important. And, you know, none of these things come out of nowhere. You know, whether it's misogyny or political persecution or racism have been around forever. So the question really is, in this moment in time, is it kind of the political environment and the rise of populism or fascism, as I call it, more accurately, is that connected? Is that a unique connection in this moment in time, do you think? Or is the historicizing of these things coming from a different place?
Thank you. Can I ask you all to be brief in responding to the questions so that we can get all of them in?
I suppose it cannot be a coincidence. We are seeing a kind of authoritarian turn all around the world, in India, in the United States, in Turkey, in Philippines. And if it's if we are facing a kind of organized evil, so we have to act within transnational solidarity actually against this evil.
Okay, I'm just going to introduce a little another aspect to this question about historicizing, which I agree with you about, you know, and in your question about history. So I think, there are people who write their own histories, which we have now become more accustomed to demanding, that it shouldn't just be some other writing your history. But I think that there will always remain a third party, a bystander, whose history it is not, and who hasn't written it, and who is not even necessarily a reader, who's watching history being written and read. And so if you think it in terms of curriculum here, when we decide what we are going to teach about, let's say, India or Turkey, right? We are making judgments from the third part. Perspective of the third person. Mm-hmm. And I think that education of that perspective is hugely important. We've left it at the point where the battle is happening between those who are directly affected and that they claim that they should be writing the history, or others who have written about them. But the everydayness of education, where ideas are reproduced and people think schools, in colleges, in universities, things are taught, textbooks are written. That creating of the atmosphere within which some people are battling who's going to write whose history, that atmosphere is just happening. And I think we really need to attend to that also. Mm,
thank you.
That's all, yeah.
I will just say that agreeing with both of you, and also I'm from the United States, and there was a lot of, and I was there when Trump was elected, and there was a lot of shock about his election that kind of reverberated, I think, across the world. If you actually do attend to history, it's not such a shock. There are a lot of things that happened that preceded this that led to this moment in particular ways, and not in an instrumental way, but that there were, you know, everyday things that, like you said, we ignored because we thought they weren't that big of a deal. They weren't, you know, and those accumulate, including things like global recession, economic recession, and growing normalization of racism, and the way in which, you know, information is presented to us in the media. So I think that social change is always about history for me, and I'm a really impatient person, so it's often difficult to reconcile those things, but that in order for us to actually see some kind of change in terms of social justice, we have to attend to not to the kind of the relationship between history and the everyday. We can focus on these moments that are kind of spectacular disasters, like Trump, right? But that he's, you know, I'm sure he'd love for me to call him that. But that's not the bigger issue. The bigger issue is the long durée, and how it then comes to organize our lives.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Dean Ware, and I'm a unemployed computer programmer at the moment. I was just thinking, you've mentioned Trump there. I was wondering, all this is online and the Twitter storms and all that. Do you think Trump controls, somehow uses trolls himself as some sort of political force? And is he a troll himself?
It's a great question.
So who would, asking me?
I think maybe, yes, Sarah, maybe if you address that.
Well, I did just call him a spectacular disaster. So framing that, I think that there are many, many different ways to be media savvy. And I think that it is a tragedy to underestimate the media savviness of Donald Trump, because I do think that he uses the media in a very specific and intentional way, and it ends up working every single time. You know, so he'll tweet something that is outrageous, that is a complete lie, and instead of, again, figuring out the ways in which to reveal this as a lie, there are more tweets about it. And then the media covers it, and they said, oh my, can you believe it? This is happening again. And it becomes, and he is fully aware of how he's created that, you know, kind of particular shitstorm, if you will. You know, and so I mean, I don't know if he's a troll. I think that we can call him lots of things. I don't know if it matters to me if he, in fact, is a troll. What does matter to me is that I think he's underestimated in terms of how he directs a particular kind of vicious rhetoric that the media continues to report instead of revealing them as lies and falsehoods and danger, right?
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. There's a question at the back, and I think after that we're going to have to wrap it up.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I sympathize with the academics here for the difficulties they have in trying to do research. I just quickly want to brief here about my... I've lived here most of my life, really, came when I was in my 20s, and now I'm nearly crossed 70. And I'm Indian, born in a Hindu family, and unfortunately in a Brahmin family, which I didn't realize was going to be damaged because I was born in a Brahmin. Now I'm realizing that. I didn't realize when I was running in Moss Side as a social worker, going to black families, you know, criminals, prostitutes, etc., all kinds of socially deprived people. I never said I was a Brahmin, but now the caste system is the what shall I say, people focus on caste system rather than human rights violation, and I lost my job, career, everything, and pension and everything, institutional racism by council, and criminal entry into my home, in airport I've been harassed every time. So you mention it, you know, financial ombudsman, you mention it, I've tried. European Court of Human Rights, within 3 months they turned me down twice. So the courts have said, no merit, sit down, Mrs. Banerjee, you have no case. So, you know, this is the way things have gone in Britain. So I would request the panel also to look at individual cases in this country, human rights, misogyny, victims of those issues, like people like Shami Chakrabarty and Shakuntala, who are in good position. I was an academic as well, lecturing in a college, but I was finished off and destroyed. Criminal entry, also. I was a mother of two babies, and I is there any hope? Can you suggest a way forward? Please. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Should I? Anybody?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, your statement is quite interesting in many ways, and I think is very typical also in many ways of what I was actually criticizing, that is personalizing the issue. Whilst it's understandable that you feel very aggrieved that your particular plight is, seems to be ignored when questions are being raised about casteism, which typically do not affect someone who is from the so-called upper caste, right? I understand that feeling that you say, but just for a minute think, it'd be very hard first in this country to meet non-Brahmins, let alone Dalits, who have reached your position of being a lecturer. Very hard. So if you were just doing person-to-person comparison, that the first block is this, that you reach a certain position and then you got knocked off. And there are other people who are still on the first step. So that's the person-to-person comparison, which I think we should you know, be concerned with. But I think it actually deflects the issue, because nothing that is said in support of providing protection against caste discrimination is actually going to work against individual cases like yours. Nothing. And I, the opposition to adding caste equality act tried to deflate and deflect the issue and present it as if it was anti-upper caste. It never was meant to be. It's not going to be, because the Equality Act applies equally, offers protection equally to everyone, regardless of what caste they are from. So I think it's a bit of a mistake to see that now you're attending to those people, you're not looking at me. So there is, first of all, I have already said that I think this is not about looking at this or that person. It's looking at structures that need to change in order to accommodate problems which affect everybody. They don't just affect one particular section. Is that okay for now? Okay.
I'm talking about human rights violations. Because you've got caste that we're talking about, means that. I'm talking about human rights, racism, misogyny, all kinds of things, violence against women, you know, and another, and these kind of employment, pension, everything.
Yeah.
You name it, I've lost it. Institutional racism. These are the issues. I'm not talking about caste. Because somebody's talking about caste, I raise. Otherwise, I wouldn't be raising this issue.
Yeah,
saying,
thank you.
I was excluded from Asian societies, ostracized, you know, marginalized. In UK, I'm talking about UK. It's all about UK. Because I came with a degree.
Yeah.
I studied here and I did
job.
On
it is correct.
I think we hear what you're saying.
Clarified myself because we went on the wrong thing, which is caste. I never raised caste.
Okay.
I think you can see that the kinds of things the panelists have been speaking about are ones which actually, if people were to move forward in solidarity on these issues, they would be ones which would probably address the issues that you have talked about, all of those issues, particularly racism, which is knitted in with misogyny, as Sarah said, which is knitted in with caste, which is knitted in with people who have come from overseas and speak other languages here. So all of these things, it's not just about saying, well, you're addressing this, but you've left out all these other things. We are addressing this in a very specific context, which is the UK today. And we are actually saying we want to take responsibility as academics with some form of power in this situation. So kudos to you for speaking up on your own behalf. It is very hard to do that, but also try to see the connections between your case and our struggles.
I'll just quickly say that, in fact, I have always presented casteism as a kind of racism.
It is.
So for me, these are not opposite. These are fights and struggles which reinforce each other. So,
absolutely. Well, can I ask the audience to join me in thanking the panelists for their...